and welcome to the inaugural episode of the Morbid Anatomy Transmission. I'm your host, Molly McBride Jacobson. This is the official podcast of the Morbid Anatomy Museum in Brooklyn, New York. On this series, I'm going to be interviewing experts and eccentrics who provide lectures and workshops, curate exhibits, and generally contribute to the study of the strange and obscure. Today, I'm talking to Joanna Ebenstein, who is the Morbid Anatomy's founder and director. We talk a little bit about goings-on at the museum and death culture of today and yesteryear.
Just to start off, how do you explain what the Morbid Anatomy Museum is to people?
We have a lot of challenges about trying to express what the Morbid Anatomy Museum is, because it's so many things, honestly. We started in a really backwards way. We started as a website, then we started a open-to-the-public research library, then a lecture series, and now we have this museum. And museum is a good word, and it's the right word to talk to an audience about it, but institute might actually be a better word, because so much of what we do is about our public programming. And to express all of those things in one sentence, we've found impossible. What our mission statement is, which is still under development, we're committed to the education and exhibition of things that are forgotten or fall between the cracks.
Personally and professionally, what led you to create the museum to be what it is now?
Yeah, so the museum has a really odd genealogy. It started for me as an artist project. So in 2007, I started photographing at medical museums and old natural history museums, looking at wet specimens and especially wax simulacrums of the human form that were used to teach students anatomy in the 18th and 19th century. And I came back from this trip I did, a one-month pilgrimage, as I called it, to the great medical museums of Europe and the United States. I had literally tens of thousands of photographs. I had all these articles to read. I had books that I'd been ordering the whole time. And I began to immerse myself in this material in order to figure out what I wanted to say in the exhibition. So in order to kind of sort through all that material, I created this blog. And it never occurred to me that this would be of interest to anybody else. It was just my way of organizing. I had all of these links to museums all around the world, links to all the online resources I was using, a bibliography of all the books I was using, and almost immediately this blog developed a following. And soon after, I started to get emails from people asking if I had certain books that were in the bibliography, which I did, and a lot of these books are really hard to acquire. I felt strongly that I should make those available to people, so I soon after opened a space in this artist studio, a 300-square-foot space where I made all of my books and artifacts available to the public. So that was the Morbid Anatomy Library, and that was in 2008. Then in 2009, I just knew all these people in the medical museum world and in kind of this greater world of history of medicine, artists dealing with the uncanny, all of this sort of thing, and I started to invite them to give presentations at the space. Then I met a woman named Tracy Hurley Martin, and Tracy Hurley Martin came to the library, the old library, and she fell in love with it, and she said, you know, this is great. I always thought there should be kind of a gift shop cafe like this. And I said, there should be, and I could build you a great museum to go with that. I emailed her a couple months later, and she was really working on it. And soon we were actually having real conversations about staffing and buildings and lawyers, and it just happened.
Explain a little bit how the library works. Is that open to the public? Is it?
Yeah, so the Morbid Anatomy Library is part of our exhibition space. So we have two exhibition spaces. One is temporary, one is permanent. The Morbid Anatomy Library is our permanent collection. People can go in there. They can handle anything that's in an open case, which is nearly everything. So they can handle wet specimens. They can touch bones. They can touch a cast of a gorilla foot. They can pick books off the shelf and sit down and make themselves at home. They can talk to our docents, and we can guide them to certain other books. It's also open to researchers. So if there's any research listening, you just have to write a letter of inquiry and then we allow you in free of charge.
Where do you see it going from here? Do you have plans to expand, or is it kind of just going where it goes?
Well, the way I've done everything in my life is just doing what feels right and then responding to what comes next. But that said, what I would like, my dream five-year plan is that, of course, we get a bigger space. Because, as you know, we're really limited to what we can do in the space, so it's fine for where we are now. I'd like to have a more robust and ambitious publishing program. Last year, we published this book, The Morbid Anatomy Anthology, which is a 500-page collection of some of our best essays. I'm a book designer by profession. I'm a book collector by proclivity, so I would really, really like to make more books. I'd like to do more ambitious programming. Right now, most of our lectures are kind of one-off lectures, or we have weekend workshops. I'd like to do 10-week classes that are the kind of things you can't teach elsewhere.
So you just mentioned the events that you guys do here, which span from workshops to lectures to film screenings. What can people expect out of an evening at one of these events?
Our topics are varied. You know, basically anything that is slightly offbeat, esoteric, or interesting to us is game. But the commonalities you'll find between that is mostly our audience. We have a lot of repeat people, but even when it's not repeat people, it's a certain kind of person that tends to be drawn here. And I would describe them as very smart, people who ask really interesting questions, and a non-academic atmosphere in the sense that, you know, when I go to academic conference so often, you see people picking apart people's arguments. There's this real almost glee in attack. And that's not what our environment is about. It's more a collegial place to learn and meet like-minded people than it is a place to show one's superiority.
Yeah, it really does seem like sort of a lovely community surrounding the weird.
Yeah, and actually that is what I've realized since we opened the space, really what we are. We do have an exhibition space, and we do have lectures, and we do have a gift shop and a cafe and all of those things, but all of those things together create a space for people who aren't taken seriously and people whose interests don't fit the mainstream. And I think our exhibition that we have right now is a really great example of that. It's called Collector's Cabinet, and it's 26 collectors, all from our community, and just showcasing the amazing things that they have in their collections, and the captions are written in their own words. And I think, again, these are things that wouldn't be shown by normal museums because they're not important enough, or they're not scientific enough, or they're seen as perhaps sensational, or perhaps only interesting. Which is sad to think that only interesting isn't good enough. But for us, just allowing people to have this encounter with material culture from the past is a really important thing, whether or not it has a component that goes beyond that.
You described what kind of people are attracted to the museum, and that's certainly a wide variety. What do you say to people who might be a little freaked out by, you know, skeletons and taxidermied ducklings and that sort of thing?
Honestly, those people might not like it here. I mean, the only thing I would say is, there's something about the space, and this has everything to do with our architects. They created a space that frames these things in a way that's not dark or macabre or sinister or subcultural. It's actually quite accessible and quite beautiful, and I think the frame allows people to see them as beyond the shock value, beyond the way in which they tend to be approached and see them as objects of beauty.
So what do you think we can gain by examining things, like you said, that fall through the cracks?
Yeah, but to me, you know, my background is intellectual history, and I feel like when part of the historical record is lost, a truth isn't being told anymore. And to me, looking at these things, for example, our first exhibition was called The Art of Mourning, and it was all mourning artifacts from the 19th century, mostly the 19th century. And it told a different story about the Victorians than we know. I know this because people would come in, and, you know, we had things in the exhibition like post-mortem photographs, and more interestingly, it turned out, was hair art. So there was this whole tradition in the 19th century of doing all this stuff with human hair. Sometimes they would make shadow boxes, and they'd make these very ornate wreaths out of human hair. Sometimes it would be a ring, and it would be a braid or a plait. But people came in, and I would listen because I would docent. They just couldn't believe it existed. They had never heard of something like this. Just because you don't want to believe something exists, or because it's seen as so weird by the culture and at the moment, we don't quite know what to do with hair art, for example. Like, is it art? Is it craft? Is it an embarrassing part of our background that our grandparents did? Knowing about that deepens our understanding of the time and complicates our ideas about our own boundaries and our own categories, I think. When, to me, looking at all these things from the past and seeing so many of them together and realizing, no, this wasn't just some, what we would now think of as a morbid person taking pictures of dead babies, this was a cultural thing that happened, right? So if that's the case, then why does it look so strange to us now? And why necessarily is it morbid?
It's interesting that you mentioned The Art of Mourning, which I absolutely adored.
Thank you.
It really demonstrated how grief used to be this really public act.
Yes.
And it was sort of this thing that everyone was experiencing together. And now it seems like we grieve in private, and that's something we have sort of secluded to the private sphere. How do you think our attitude towards morbidity and death has changed? And when do you think that happened and why?
I agree totally with what you're saying. And I think I would also add one thing that I find really interesting. One of the pieces in the Morbid Anatomy Anthology by Colin Dickey, who was our managing director for a while, he wrote this great piece about the pathology of mourning, the way it's been pathologized, like basically in how the psychiatric recommendations change. So basically, the time for appropriate mourning, as far as the psychiatric literature, gets smaller and smaller. And if you go beyond that 2 month, 2 week, whatever it is now, then it's considered a pathological grief. And this idea that grief is a pathology is really strange to me. And I think it's something very American. I mean, I don't know if it is only in America, but this idea that happiness is a virtue to be courted above everything else, and that somehow thinking about things that are not happy makes you a weird or bad person. You know, I don't think any other culture gets to think that way. There's this American idea that we could create a utopia in which the harder, darker parts of life don't exist. It's almost like wish fulfillment. Maybe it's because we're a young country. Maybe it's because it's where everyone came when horrible, horrible, horrible things were happening elsewhere, famines and massacres and all of this. Maybe everybody needs to believe in a place like that. As far as like when this happened, my belief is it was the transition between 1880 and 1930, and this is kind of when we were becoming who we are now. Before this, funerals they happen in the home, in the parlor. Women clean and lay out the body. You see all these photographs you saw in Art of Mourning of these coffins laid out in the parlor. Around this time, between these years, this idea of a good death and dying at home disappears and it becomes dying at the hospital. Then the funeral parlor pops up, and the parlor at home becomes the living room, because it's no longer the parlor. It's no longer a place to lay out the dead. It's a place for the living. You know, another thing to remember is in the 19th century, 3 out of 5 children died before reaching adulthood. Many, many people were in mourning. Now I think we see an early death as this horrible exception. And I think back then it was no less horrible, but it was not an exception, and it happened a lot. And so when you look at all those artifacts, I think you see that. And I think you also see, to me, especially with the hair art, and this ties into a class we have here. So, you know, hair art has always been very interesting to me. And we met a woman named Karen Bachman. And she is a master jeweler who became obsessed with hair art. She was collecting it. And she basically reverse engineered how it was made and started making it herself. And when you actually try to work with human hair and make something even halfway decent with it, and then you look at those pieces and you think, you know, you remember that very large shadow box. Like, that must have taken years. Like, really. And that makes you think of a lot of things. First of all, women were at home and not in the workplace at that point, so they had years to do this. But second of all, it made me think a lot about how the time that you spend is almost a way of dealing with grief as well. It's like doing a practice, a ritual that's dedicated to this lost beloved. And I would be very surprised if that didn't help with grieving. So that maybe it's not only about the finished product that you hang in your home, but it's also about the year that you spend every day making something beautiful with the remains of your loved one.
If there's any artifact existing, or it may be to exist in the future, that you'd like to have for the museum, what would it be?
I don't have to think twice. Great. The anatomical Venus. And this is a human-sized wax woman built in the 1770s or 1780s, and she's dissectable. She's very beautiful. She has long flowing hair. The most famous one has a string of pearls around her neck. And her eyes are open, Venetian glass eyes. She's like a princely object that was intended also to teach anatomy to a general public, not a medical public, which I think is really interesting, at one of the first public science museums in the world. The goal with her was to be able to teach anatomy in a positive way without any reminder of its sullied roots, which come from dead bodies. You know, countless dead bodies were dissected, putrefying dead bodies, no doubt, to cast each perfect organ, each pristine organ that she has. So you can lift up her breastplate, and then you can take out her pieces. You can demount her, dissect her, auto-dissect her. You don't have to be a doctor to do this. And then at the very end, the last thing you see is a fetus in her womb. The presence of a full-sized, too beautiful to really be real, but seeming to be alive, yet dead. There's all of these conflicting edges there that I think are so interesting. I think the reason the Venus is impossible for us to understand is we have changed so much since that time, and our categories have become binarily opposed that used to seamlessly merge in her. So these ideas of life and death, or body and soul, or religion and medicine, all of these things trouble, beauty and death maybe being the biggest, where that's now seen as a contradiction in terms. That wasn't the case in the 18th century. There was a way to find beauty and death, and I think there probably was in most every culture.
That's it for the Morbid Anatomy transmission. Thank you so much for listening to this, our very first episode. Please subscribe to and review the podcast on iTunes. I'd appreciate all the feedback I can get. If this has piqued your curiosity, you can visit morbidanatomymuseum.org or shoot an email to info@morbidanatomy.org. On the website, you can learn more about the current exhibition, Collector's Cabinet, which will be up until March 29th. You can also find out about the museum's many events, some of which include Boneyards, a solo performance by Jeffrey Stanley on March 6th, and Experimenting with Death, an introduction to the terror management theory of human behavior on March 18th. I'll be interviewing presenter Michael Johns on terror management theory in the next episode, so be sure to stay tuned for that. And now I'll leave you, as I plan on ending every transmission, with some famous last words. These ones came from killer Robert Alton Harris, who said, "You can be a king or a street sweeper, but everyone dances with the Grim Reaper."